This interview is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. In Practice is an independent publisher, and all opinions expressed by guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of In Practice.
So, welcome, dear listeners, to this episode on primary research methods. In a previous few episodes, we've talked about submitting fieldwork projects to networks. We've talked about how to work with networks effectively, a range of ideas on that, and on our own fieldwork process, how we approach fieldwork as part of our investment research process. This week, we're talking about how we vet executives, with particular attention to how we've done this in and around our study of the business of TransDigm. Will, I think a bit of context on your interest in this business is useful to set the scene.
I'd been studying the commercial aerospace market, and I think originally through the lens of actually the engine OEMs, so GE and the CFM engine, and their shift to aftermarket focused, powered by the hour type agreements. And obviously I'd known about TransDigm and HEICO. And so I'd always been interested in how the aftermarket was structured in the way it is. So an average 787 might have a couple million parts on a plane, right? And just assembling those and the whole supply chain for that plane is pretty incredible and complicated and difficult to organize, but also means there's various niches and various different product categories that can create quite interesting businesses. And so when studying TransDigm, when I came across TransDigm, it was pretty interesting that it was solely focused on that aftermarket, mainly focused on that aftermarket in terms of where they were trying to really buy assets. And I think it was back when, I think Citroen done a short report on it in maybe 2017 or maybe a bit later, that I'd explored that. And so there's always this discussion around, you know, are they just hiking prices and are they just price gouging? They had the stuff with, you know, defense contracts where Howdy was in Congress testifying. And so there was that whole sentiment around the business that they were really just buying these assets and hiking prices. Kind of like, you know, similar to Constellation in a way, where some people just think they kind of do the same thing in VMS. And so part of the project that I was interested in was, okay, let's actually understand how TransDigm operates, how it's structured the way it is, i.e. it's very decentralized. So how are people held accountable throughout the organization? How is it structured from organizationally? And also, how does it really buy and operate its assets post-acquisition? And with the hypothesis that, you know, to kind of prove and disprove if there was any additional value being created beyond just price increases. And so that was the real context, because, yeah, with my intuition was that it's not just price increases. There's always, for a business to be, you know, around for that long and that the margin profile and the free cash flow that sustainable, it's typically not just huge price increases, which is kind of what Citroen originally argued. That was a bit of the context.
So as you prepared to source for this business, let's look at the profiles that seemed attractive to you. Let's talk about, you know, and all this is working towards how we actually vet people and assess their ability to make a contribution. You've pretty clearly laid out the context there. Who in particular did you think you needed to speak to?
TransDigm is interesting in this perspective because it's fairly, well, it's decentralized. I mean, that means that if you think about the org structure, you have, at this time, you had Howley at the top, kind of same structure. Howley was as an exec chair, former CEO, exec chair. You had Kevin Steyer as CEO, and then you had, I think at the time, you had Bob Henderson as a vice chair, and then you had, I think you had a COO at the time, and you have CFO and Bernie doing M&A. And then underneath that, you had these kind of five to six EVPs, right, which are which they were responsible for 5 to 7 OPCO units, you know, i.e. subsidiaries. And the turnover at that high end of the COOs and the EVPs is very, very low at TransDigm. And there's probably been, I don't know, 10, you know, maybe 12 EVPs in the history of TransDigm, right? So it's very unlikely you're going to find someone who is super senior there that is willing to talk, or even, you know, they've obviously made a few bucks as well. They're not interested in doing this type of stuff. At least in our industry, in terms of how people reach out to these types of people, they're not even going to be on LinkedIn to in a certain extent, right? So the focus was really on subsidiary level within the subsidiary. So what happens is you have this org structure, right, decentralized. You have the 5 to 7 EVPs, which are kind of like mini CEOs in a way. They manage 5 to 7 subsidiaries. Within a subsidiary, right, you have a president, which is kind of like the CEO of that operating company. And these opcos could be doing, you know, they might be making, you know, one of them does cargo handling system for freighters, right? So when a plane goes from cargo to, switches from commercial to freight, they make these cargo handling systems that rail in the bottom of the freighter plane, right? And it does $50 million. So, and these EVPs will manage 5 to 7 of those businesses. I was focused really on the subsidiary level. At the subsidiary level, you have a president, and then, which is kind of like the CEO of that OPCO. And then you have this, which is where I was focused with this role called, like, the head of director in sales and marketing. And underneath them, which is kind of like, it's a sales role effectively. And these are the guys that report to Howley and Kevin in the quarterlies. They do those famous quarterly kind of meetings in Cleveland or, you know, around the US, where this is the role, the director of sales and marketing report to Nick and Kevin on their numbers and how they're performing on the 3 P's, their methodology. And then below that, they're split by product line. So at TransDigm, you'll each have one product line, which is basically, they call it a business unit manager, which effectively is managing sales, marketing, and the 3 P's, right? So new business development, pricing, and productivity, i.e. cost, for that product line. So these people are effectively like kind of mini CEOs of a product line, but they touch manufacturing, engineering, quality, pricing, sales, new business for their specific, for one product line within an OPCO. You know, and they do that because they kind of prime them to be promoted to director, then president, and hopefully EVP over time. And so the hypothesis was that those people have a kind of touch all parts of TransDigm's model and really pull the levers at on the ground level of those 3 P's. Price, you know, productivity and I guess reducing and new business. Reducing cost of new business and pricing. So really I was focused on two roles, which was the president of the OPCO, i.e. the senior, you know, the CEO is running that kind of cargo handling business, and or those business unit managers, which were effectively implementing on a day-to-day basis the 3 P's and understand how TransDigm operate, i.e. could explain how, where the EBITDA accretion is coming from post-acquisition, where TransDigm can typically see 10 to 20 percentage points of EBITDA margin accretion in the 3 to 5 years post-acquisition. And so the idea was to get to, you know, multiple of those people across different businesses, subsidiaries that TransDigm acquired, and just have case studies. Okay, let's walk us through this. Okay, you buy the business, TransDigm buy the business. How did you change? How was it structured pre-acquisition, post-acquisition? How did you pull the 3 levers? How did you reduce cost? How did you increase price? How did you create new business? And the outcome. And those two types of role proved to be pretty interesting in actually explaining how this works.
How much of this were you aware of before the first call? Because if we're talking about vetting here, we're talking about trying to identify people that can add value to a line of questioning. And what you've just described is the amount of knowledge, you know, and there's a beauty here, which is understanding how the business is structured almost by definition gives you a bearing. You know, if you actually find someone with this job title that's been in the role for any number of years, you know you've got something pretty interesting.
Right. And I mean, it's no secret how TransDigm are structured, right? I mean, they showed that in the capital markets day since they were listed. So you've got, you know, decade of investor days that show the structure. So that was, you know, where I kind of found that structure. And obviously you can just go through all their historical subsidiaries and find the CEO of that subsidiary. So it's not rocket science, right? I think where it gets tricky is below, you know, for example, if you go on LinkedIn and try and find the CEO of Adele Wiggins, right, which is an opco, you'll find a president or a president there, which is the guy who runs Adele Wiggins. Then when you get, most of those people, by the way, don't leave TransDigm. If you have a president of an opco, there could be $100 million business and you've got a chance of being an EVP. So they don't really turn over that much. And it's the people underneath that are actually implementing the 3Ps. And that's where their title is not crystal clear. And so I think it's, you know, part of the vetting process is just about understanding what the person really does on a day-to-day basis.
So let's hold on a second here for context. You've done that work on the background of the business. You've done the work necessary on the org structure, going through the filings. This could be months of work as you're reading up on the business, learning about how it functions, learning about how it structures. You then get out, you identify profiles of people who are seemingly relevant. Okay, and so let's say a few people get back with these relevant titles. You get one on the phone.
Part of it is just understanding really what they do on a day-to-day basis. And now, the challenge in this expert network industry is that the people conducting the introductory calls, i.e. vetting the executives, are not the ones that typically understand TransDigm or the company. And so part of our work at IP, part of how we're structured, is to empower and foster that knowledge in the people doing the vetting so that they can have great conversations and be able to vet these people. But there's always that, it's always on the spectrum.
Well, yeah, but I mean, every network says they do that.
True, right? But then, you know, they're not also structured in a way of doing that. That's the other challenge with them, right?
Well, that's it. So say more about that.
Well, like I said, part of the way we're structured is that we have analysts and recruiters working together so that they can bridge that gap of the huge asymmetry of information you have between the client, the hedge fund, and the network. And also that, you know, the game that we're playing also means that we are incentivized to find the best people, because also our competitors in the market can lend on their scale as their product, whereas we have to really actually add value and produce a quality library, which means you've got to find good people. So it's a different game that we're playing. But I think it's still difficult. Even if I know TransDigm, like I actually have vetting someone, is still, you know, it's not easy. And people try and bullshit you all the time, right? And so I think it's part of it is understanding, first step is understanding where they fit into the organization and having some kind of structure in your mind of how TransDigm is organized and where this person fits in, i.e. what are they responsible for on a day-to-day basis, right? And my focus here was to really understand, okay, you know, you're selling a cargo handling machine to a freighter airline. Well, were you responsible for pricing this product? Explain that to me. How often did the pricing? Did you sign off on the contract? How much was the typical system? How much of business do you sign on your product line per year? Like, you know, and you can then see, you know, really if that person is signing off on a contract on that, you know, I can use that as a specific case study to explore. All right, it's one product in the hundreds or thousands of TransDigm sells. But it's a specific case study that may reflect the broader principles on which TransDigm operates under. And so, you know, part of it is just really understanding exactly what that person does on a day. And you'd be surprised at how, like, putting your ego aside and asking very simple questions can go a pretty long way.
I think it's important to articulate, like, you're talking about when you've identified someone relevant, when you've managed to persuade them to get on the phone. You know, these are busy people. You've got them on a phone call. Talk about what leads someone to be responsive to this kind of detailed questioning. Because I think the pushback that you get from people listening who know this business is, well, you know, why would executives take what you're describing is clearly a conversation that's going to take more than 5 minutes. Now, this could be, to get the information you're talking about, this could be 30 minutes on the phone. So why are these people taking 30 minutes on the phone with you?
Most people want to talk about how great they are. Part of it is massaging egos. No, but it's.
Well, I don't know if that's the biggest part, though. I'm kind of. I think at some point you'll say it, but maybe I'll go there, which is just showing that respect that you've actually properly done work and you have a sense for what they do, and you've shown that, like, just that basic respect for their life and their career. Is it more than that?
Yeah, but you don't. I mean, like, if you walk through the process, though, right? Like, most time is there's an outbound email process or call, right? Where, frankly, like, you're not showing respect at that point, right? You've got the first few minutes to build respect for people and actually capture their imagination in a way, right? So everyone starts off kind of the same footing. We often send stuff to executives. We might tweak a certain email differently that suggest something that we're coming at this a different angle. You know, so a lot of the time that I might share an insight that I've already explored or found, you know, through our work, or it might even be something, you know, even public information on the around the company that you can kind of, you know, show that you're different to most people reaching out to them. But still, you know, it doesn't change it hugely, especially at the beginning when we didn't really have a brand. It's a bit different now where they can kind of see what we're about, but I think when you get them on the phone, then it's, yeah, then it's really about, I mean, then we can have a conversation about this, right? It's the art of conversation. How do you make people feel good, right? How do you show respect but also help them learn? A lot of these people, they don't necessarily do this for the money. Obviously, getting paid is a nice bonus, you know, and it's important for most people, but not all. What they're really interested in, especially the best people, is having a great conversation, learning. And sense checking their views. They follow the market. They continue to follow stuff when they retire. So they're always interested in having great conversations. So if you can help them learn, and then whilst you're doing that, you know, you're making them feel good, you're helping them learn, but then you're also vetting them. Like, it's not as simple as I'm just going to call you up and ask you like these poignant questions around, did you sign the contract? Did you do this? Like, it's a way more subtle process than that, that involves helping them learn and sharing what we're actually exploring and why we think this matters. Providing the perspective on what investors may be looking at that they're interested in around the F sector, around the companies that they've been involved in. And then you kind of weave in this vetting process, which is trying to understand exactly what they've done on the ground. Right? So it's not a kind of survey format. It's, you know, it's way more subtle than that. And, you know, and also it's quite an art rather than a science, to be honest.
Well, it is, and it is an art, and there's nuances to it that arise on a case-by-case basis. I think that's what makes the work fun. I think it's almost easier to say what vetting is not. And from our perspective, what vetting is not is sending an executive a list of five questions asking them, you know, over email, can you talk about X, Y, Z, or getting them on the phone and asking them, can you talk about ABC? Right, that from our perspective is not vetting. That what we've just articulated is a whole process of preparation up to you know, before even getting on a call, to actually understand what kind of person you're dealing with. Once that's done, to get into the actual meat of the intro call process, right? And you've alluded to this, that you're trying to understand what someone did. You personally have probably, my guess is, when you've done over 1,500 interviews, my guess is you've run probably north of 400 or 500 intro calls yourself over the last 5 years, right? Could be more. What can we offer here to pull out of this experience of a few hundred of these vetting calls, that maybe on a level that's a bit more specific?
Maybe I can start with like what at least is my most common mistake historically, maybe still today, frankly, is sourcing people that are good, you know, decent, and were involved at the company at the time and were interested, but we're just too far away. We're not really accountable. And this is like where this kind of accountability and responsibility comes in, right? It's like, you know, for example, let's say if I'm exploring pricing a Transdigm or just the operational philosophy Transdigm. Well, you know, back to that org structure, right? Of you got at the opco, you got the president, you got director of sales and marketing, you got the business unit managers. You've also got other people. You've got a director of engineering, a controller, a plant manager. Well, if you found a plant manager, I'm pretty damn sure he's going to tell you how they price and how they operate and tell you how you can talk about the three P's and talk about, you know. And so, but that's not someone who's truly accountable for executing that. They're responsible for manufacturing and moving widgets in and out of the box of the plant, right? So it's part of the mistakes, and you can relate that to any kind of project that we have where it's someone that's involved in the company in and around decision-making, but is not accountable for. They're not the one that are going through that real decision-making process on the levers or what at least we think matters or what we're trying to test. So, and that kind of comes down to, you know, part of, in my experience, a few of the mistakes have been miscalculating the org structure. So you don't really know that they're the wrong person because you don't understand how this business is organized. Because people can really persuade you, and they can, you know, if you don't know anything about, I've never sold an aerospace part in my life, but I've never worked at Transdigm. So if I'd never looked at this properly before for years and I get a plant manager who's doing this day in, day out for 20 years and I don't know the org structure, I might not even know that there's this kind of business unit manager role that is the guy that's really accountable for it. And they have to go and report to Howley. These guys have to go and report the numbers of the opco to Howley and Kevin, not this plant manager guy. So I think this mistake typically happens because I don't know the org structure enough, or I'm not vetting correctly, and I'm not going through that process in the integral process, which is really understanding what they're accountable for. And back to the kind of, again, it's an art and it's a dance. You know, it's not, I'm not as blunt, or, you know, you have to be direct with this stuff because otherwise, you know, you get too many fuzzy responses. But it's an art and a dance when you're speaking to them, and how you vet them whilst making them feel good and comfortable, and, you know, not uncomfortable in terms of what they're sharing, etc. But if you have a conversation with someone and you're asking them, was you involved in the contract negotiation? You know, did you sign off on this? You know, it's rare you're going to have someone that's going to say yes when they didn't sign off on it. You know, and therefore you can get a sense, or they're going to feel uncomfortable, their body language will change, and their tone of voice will change. And therefore, you can quickly get a sense on how really involved that person may be. So I think, the biggest mistake, at least that I have in this process, is finding someone who's involved but just a bit too far away. So when you get them on an interview, you can't really go to that true level and depth that's required. And that happens mainly, in my experience, from two things. It's not doing the vetting properly, and it's also, and it's all, or I just don't understand the org structure in the company enough.
How much emphasis have you put over time in establishing what people can't talk about, or establishing the limits of what they're capable of?
Yeah, I mean, that's also, it can often be an easier first question to get into that type of discussion on what they're really being responsible for. You know, it's actually exploring what can they not talk about. If you give people an inch, they will bullshit you, right? And it won't necessarily be, you know, pure BS. It will be like just a bit fluffy on their responses. And so, you know, it's.
Well, I think, and let's honor the fact that people are just well-intentioned and they want to please. And it's quite a dangerous setup that I think is actually not talked about enough in our line of work.
But my point is that the dynamic of the conversation is fundamentally that you're typically calling someone up to chat to them and pay them for their time, right? As a sign of respect, but, you know, which is important. Yeah, and therefore, you have to set the tone via the vetting call, which communicates on the level of depth and understanding that is expected. And so, for example, if I call a plant manager up at Transdigm, he will 100% tell me he can discuss the three P's. And he would tell me how he can, you know, how he knows about the pricing. But he's not negotiating contracts. He's a plant manager. And so unless you have someone who's vetting them and understands that, you know, that's an obvious example, but it's not that obvious when you look at their plant, their titles on LinkedIn or, you know, many other companies. The point is that when you ring them up and you ask them, can you discuss this? They're going to say, yeah. And when you get into the interview, that's not good enough, right? So finding someone who's accountable.
And this is beautiful because it allows us to bring out something that we talk about a lot as being one of the most important shifts in the way we do this work. 11 into our 12th year now of this work is overcoming the temptation to fit an executive into a pre-existing box. And what you've articulated here, and I do want you to expand on this a little bit, is what does it actually mean to give someone the space to reveal what they can do and not push them or nudge them into giving you certain kinds of responses that they're already primed to do because you're offering them 500 to whatever amount of money they're asking for, right? And people generally just want to be helpful and have an inclination to be useful to you. So,
but they also think they know. The plant manager thinks he knows about how Transdigm approach pricing because he hears it. He talks to his mate at lunch and he talks to his mate at dinner and he says, "Oh yeah, this is how we." But he doesn't know. There's levels of knowing and like feeling it and living it and pricing it and being accountable for it. There's just a level of accountability that's required. And so, and I think you raise an interesting point because when I was sourcing all my interviews, I mean, I would say probably 50 to 60% of the time, I would have this hypothesis and idea of what I'm looking at, and I would source someone, and then I would onboard them and interview them on a completely different topic. Because, you know, I was trying to find someone on a certain topic, and that wasn't the right person, but he was actually very interested on a different topic. And so, you know, but I wouldn't, if I was just a man of a hammer, I would have missed that. So part of the vetting process is about exactly understanding their competence. What are they doing all day long? What are they good at? What's interesting about their role? And then, you know, we're in the position to mold interviews around them when and if it makes sense. And that was probably 50 to 60% of my calls, you know, years ago.
Well, and still today to an extent, because our process has changed to reflect it.
Yeah.
This is where the fun is. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and Adrian or the guys, they'll send me an executive and I'll be like, actually, I'm not using the firm. I want to speak to him about this.
Right. And so what clearly comes out for me here is in what you're saying, and I think what we've come to believe is that there's the real art is in, through the vetting process, understanding what someone is not just capable of touching on or addressing. It's, yes, what they're accountable for. There's then, what are they the most unique person in the world to do, right? Or do they have any unique attribute? And actually building calls at the level that, I guess, at the scale at which we operate and the amount, and granted, you know, a lot of people out there don't have, you know, $1 million fieldwork budgets, right? So we're, given the kind of work that we do, I think it has been a bit of a revelation over the years, at least to me. I don't know about you, but this process of actually building calls around people's expertise, provided it, you know, it can contribute. You're not going to call, you know, if they could talk about something unique, it has to be relevant, obviously, right?
It has to be relevant, yeah. But it's not as simple as that because, and some of the best calls, often people don't know why they're so unique. And people don't necessarily know the unique perspective they have. And sometimes it's often the people that think they have the most unique perspective, but it's not unique. Quite often, right? Or at least if they think they've got it, they've told it to millions of people, and therefore, isn't it, by definition, they're no longer unique. So I think the some of the most interesting calls that I've had, I mean, for example, the one that I've had many people reach out regarding the and this is not supposed to be a natural, it's not supposed to be a plug for our book, but I guess it's led that way. The most popular interview in the book, from the feedback I've got, has been the one on the spirits industry. And that is a prime example of that, right? Of how I'm pretty damn sure, before I reached out to him, he'd never done one of these before, because he didn't have a clue what the format of it, and I had to explain to him. And And I didn't plan on doing that until I realized his history and how he was involved in the, you know, reformulating the distribution agreements in the US. And so that is a prime example of how a formulated interview around an executive's expertise led to a certain outcome. And, you know, we can talk about this another time, but when you actually get in the process of these interviews, when you talk about a circle of competence, you know, it's a kind of Buffett fanboy quote, but people don't really know that the edge of their competence or what their kind of unique expertise or knowledge really is and how to leverage that. And I think part of the art of doing these calls and gathering potentially differentiated insight is pushing people to the edge of that competence and helping them stress test and explore what they've learned over 20, 30 years and stress test that and validate that and question that. And I think some of the best calls that we've done, or at least I've done and most enjoyable, have been when you've really restructured an interview around someone's expertise and then kind of push the limits of their circle of competence. And even then they're on the call and you can see their mind working. They're even questioning some things they know and come up with new ideas on how something may be structured in a certain way or a different strategy, for example. And that's when you get the executives to a point where they're really loving these conversations. They're learning as well.
Two things I want to pull out here. One is when an executive, when you come into a vetting call, and the executive gets the sense that you can potentially take them to the limits of their knowledge, that is something that is extremely appealing to them. That's one thing. And that allows you to actually get access to people that you may not otherwise have access to. And the second is, if it wasn't already obvious enough, one of the largest pitfalls we've come across in our careers in vetting is around forcing someone to fit in to a set of assumptions you've made about what they know.
I actually think that's partly a function of how rigid the customer is. So typically what happens is if we talk about what drives the behavior of the people running expert networks, right, in terms of how this actually plays out on a day-to-day basis, right, is that you typically have, you know, majority of the industry is consulting customers, right? McKinsey, Bain, etc. They can be quite rigid in who they look for and how and what questions they want to ask, because they're just effectively ticking boxes for their private equity client or their corporate customer. And so they have a checklist and a requirement to fulfill, and therefore they're pretty stringent on how and who they want to speak to. And therefore what happens is the expert network runs around trying to find these people and tries to mold these people into ticking those boxes. And therefore you get that situation where it's not, you're incentivizing someone to try and fit someone into a box or maybe they shouldn't fit in. And we've tried to come at it the other way, which is actually, what is this person just could be really interested and really good at?
Just ask them what they do and be just on extreme guard for what is an overall industry imperative to fit people into boxes to try to maximize volume and maximize the number of interactions that take place through the network.
The challenge in the whole industry is that this becomes a self-fulfilling or a negative feedback loop in a way, because the expert networks run around trying to fit people into boxes. The executives know they're trying to fit them into a box, so they hold back information, and the executives kind of then try and fit themselves in there in the box. So you have this kind of like ineffective mechanism of people operating, and sometimes it can be quite refreshing to just like someone call you up and ask you, like, all right, you know, what do you actually mean doing on a day-to-day basis? and so we get a lot of executives that are quite happy that we're not interested in wasting their time, which is how we started, you remember, right? We used to say to people that, look, we want a 20-minute call because we don't want to waste your time in putting you in front of people that are not going to interview you or just, you know, waste your time. So it's better off that we know exactly what you are competent at, so we can you know, actually have a good conversation.
There could be many more things to address. I think for now, this is a wrap for this episode, and we'll be here next week to talk about preparing for interviews. Thanks for listening.
As always, this is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for investment decisions. Please do your own research.